Right, Luke can all see the screen. Good afternoon, everybody. Norman, thank you very much for inviting me along. And as Norman explained, we've already had one private meeting to discuss some of these issues. Out of that was the invitation for me to come here and explain my role. I hope you can all hear me. We've got the wind competing at the top level. I think below us goes the central line occasionally, so that if you can't hear me at any stage, put your hand up, please, and try again. But Norman invited me on to explain my role in all of this as the forensic science regulator. I'm going to run through that very quickly because I think our time is better spent talking about the issues of the group rather than listening to me. I was brought into this role in February 2008 as a public appointee, appointed by the Home Secretary, but not as a civil servant, as a public appointee with my own terms and conditions of service to advise the government on the quality standards in forensic science. So not to regulate the industry, but to advise and regulate around issues of science quality. I leave you to work your way through the bullet points there. I have no statutory underpinning for my role, so the work is entirely on a consensus basis through negotiation and agreement with the many people, some of them in the room, who've worked with me over the last nearly 4 years. What I inherited when I came into post was what I describe as good old-fashioned British advocacy around the regulation of quality of forensic science. So we had a bit of something going on over here, we had a bit of practitioner registration over there, we had accreditation of DNA laboratories with additional requirements in that corner, we had medical laboratories regulated through Clinical Pathology Accreditation Limited, we had the United Kingdom Accreditation Service doing some work, we had the Council for Registration of Forensic Practitioners in existence. We have police fingerprints working in most forces of an ISO 9001 quality management system, and none of this was really glued or joined together in any coherent fashion. And there's a number of other circles you could put on that diagram which really paint this picture of advocacy. And the background, apart from the fact that the reasons for bringing me into post were a number of quality failures. So we had this sort of ad hoc arrangement going on, but things were still going wrong in the courts. We had some failures in regulation, the advocacy for delivery. We had, and this was the primary reason why the government created my post, was the move from the Forensic Science Service as the government laboratory to a commercial market supplying forensic science laboratory services. And since then we've seen more evidence of police bringing some of that work back in-house. So we needed a common standards framework around all of this to try and level it all out and make it abundantly clear what standards I, the courts, and people like you expect of forensic science and our criminal justice system. From the outset, I was told by ministers that they wanted some sort of compliance mechanism around this, and that strikes me as abundant good sense that we should have some way of checking that people are complying with the standards. And we're now into a very fast-changing landscape. So the reasons for having standards are actually underpinned in the rate of change we're going through at the moment. The best example of the rapid change is the announcement less than a year ago of the closure of the Forensic Science Service, who was supplying about 60% of forensic services across England and Wales. Hello, someone's online. Welcome. But as I've said already, there's no statutory underpinning for that work. So if you take all of this out to our huge picture, which is forensic science, the broad scope of forensic science delivered in the criminal justice system, what does good quality look like? What am I expected to deliver? Well, the more we look, the more we realise there are four cornerstones to a good quality framework. You have to have good quality management systems. And I wanted to focus, taking off the shoulders of the individual practitioner, where it rested when we had practitioner registration. I wanted it placed on the shoulders of the leaders of organisations that were providing forensic science services. So the organisations have to have effective quality management systems and evidence that they are effective. But we clearly need evidence of practitioner competence. So the individuals within those organisations, and the vast majority of forensic science is delivered by organisations, not individuals working on their own. Evidence those people are competent, they're properly recruited, trained, developed and assessed in their day-to-day work. And, very, very importantly, very clear evidence that the methods they're employing are valid and fit for purpose. 3 years ago, a group like this wouldn't be talking about evaluation of evidence, we would have been talking about validation of evidence, because that's what was the hot topic in the courts at the time, the one or two trials where the judges were critical, in their view, in the absence of properly validated methods. And fourthly, I want to see very clear evidence that these organisations are independent and objective and complying with their obligations to the courts as objective presenters of evidence. That's very relevant where you have the evidence provided by police forces who are working alongside investigators and the people whose job is to solve crime. So the focus initially has been on the laboratories, where we've identified, or people before we identified, and I've jumped onto this bandwagon, the fact that the international standard ISO 17025, which is a standard for the general requirements and the competence of testing and calibration laboratories, we've identified that actually assesses, that standard allows you to assess the four cornerstones I've put up there. So it's proved to be the bedrock, the foundation, the quality standard framework that I want for forensic science. And there are people in this room who work for laboratories that are accredited to that standard. Some have been accredited longer than others, some are quite new to it, some have been accredited for a number of years. The standard works very, very well. You're assessed against the standard by the United Kingdom Accreditation Service, a very effective compliance mechanism that has all sorts of feedback loops and process improvement loops built into it. We're also working on bespoke standards and guidance where necessary. For example, Jeff Adams over the past side there works on my team, has been supporting some work on standards for forensic pathology, which won't work from accreditation standard, but very clear standards, codes and standards published already for publication. Well, published in 2004, but since updated. So I have published a consultation about to publish the final draft of codes of practice and conduct for practitioners working in the forensic science arena. The focus, as I said already, is on laboratory activities, so the codes initially focus on forensic laboratories. So we now have police forces with in-house laboratories all signed up to a very, very clear roadmap towards accreditation to meet the standards that I want. We have all contracted forensic science services working to the accreditation standards that I want already. We're now just kicking off some work on crime scene standards. So if you take the full flow of typical forensics that goes through your crime scene, be it a burglary resident, be it a suspect, be it a victim, whatever it is, through to your laboratory. So we're now working on crime scene activities with some pilot testing of a very, very similar standard to ISO 17025, with two live tests reported to me by the end of January. Of interest today is the evidence end of this, where the evidence is presented for court. So we have a small group looking at the evaluation and presentation of evidence, and that's how Norman and I came to meet up to talk about this, because I did, I must confess, I took a big chunk of that work on hold while the team case worked its way through the courts. I was asked, invited by the Court of Appeal, to present my views on the presentation and evaluation of evidence, which we did, which helped their lordships reach their conclusion, which they didn't necessarily agree with me, but it helped them reach their conclusions in the team case. What the team case has done, and I think very successfully, quite appropriately, is light a fire upon all of this so that we can now bring it out into the open and debate the issues and reach, as Norman says, some sort of scientific consensus on the way forward, because there is not a consensus at the moment. There are people in this room with opposing views on this. There are people who regularly phone me up, email me and say, this is completely wrong, this is completely right. You think you may expect me to resolve this. Well, I can't resolve this. I need help from people like you to find a consensus way through evaluating the proper evaluation and presentation of evidence in a way that the courts will accept. Following the team decision, I've had meetings with Lord Justice Thomas and Lord Justice Hughes, and they have said to me very, very clearly, would you please work with the experts in the field to achieve a consensus that we can all work with around the evaluation and presentation of evidence in our courts? Would you please achieve a consensus on where we draw the line on the use of these reference databases, a line below which we do not tread? They are looking to us, you, me, as the experts in this, to advise them on how we proceed in the future. And the reason we've got two boxes there on the evaluation line, the interest today is the evaluation and presentation of evidence in the courts. Of course, there's an enormous value in good decision-making, i.e. evaluation of the evidence you have, driving the decision-making forensic processes right back to the beginning of the investigation. So there's equal value here. So we're talking about forensic intelligence as much as we're talking about forensic evidence, in my We have a line there on consumables, which is an active piece of work at the moment, where we look at current problems in forensic science, i.e. contamination, particularly trace evidence, DNA recovery. Contamination is a ever-pervasive problem. We want to see much more work to eliminate and manage contamination where it occurs, because it will always occur. And trace evidence is particularly human DNA. Crime scenes are inherently contaminated. So we have to manage that out as best as possible. A lot of very good stuff being done at the moment. That line of work is all about a new British standard for the consumables, the swabs, the reagents, the containers, and everything else that's brought in to the forensic process to make sure they're up to standard to help us deal with contamination and evidence preservation issues. And then we have a whole list of other pieces of work going on in the background to pretend to develop standards around forensic pathology, around standards around DNA, digital evidence, archaeology, anthropology. That list will have about 60 different disciplines on it by the time we've finished it, all the different forensic disciplines. There's some work going on at the Natural History Museum at the moment, forensic entomology, and they are working with statisticians to see how they can present their evidence. I've asked them just to hold fire on that slightly so we can have perhaps a longer chat with them and make sure that they stay on track. All of this combines together to add to the codes of practice that we will publish again and again and again in the future as the work grows and is published for consultation and use in the criminal justice system. Those codes have no statutory underpinning. People are being asked to buy into them, which most people are. I say they have no statutory. There is at the moment European legislation, the European Framework Decision from November 2009, that requires all DNA and fingerprint laboratories to be accredited to the 70025 standard. I'm using that as a lever at the moment to bring laboratories, some laboratories that aren't accredited, into the framework that I want. That legislation is currently under review as part of a UK option to opt out of all these European framework decisions in the summer of 2014. So it might not exist, it might remain, we don't know, we wait to find out. But on the whole, this is all delivered in the absence of any statutory underpinning, through the help of people like you to help us achieve consensus on the way forward. So the plea is to help us deliver that consensus. In terms of the evaluation of evidence, one of the immediately obvious things is that the evidence has to be presented in a very, very transparent fashion. I'm sure Karen's going to underline that point in her talk in a minute. So that when you are evaluating presenting evidence, be very, very open and clear in what you're doing. And Jeff's been doing some early work on some guidance that we can publish around this. I'm sure transparency is central. I'm sure this will come out of the talk in here around the team case as well. Because part of the problem, I think, in the team case was that the work was in the background and wasn't particularly open and available. I think that's enough, Karen. Any questions?